On this week's episode of Video Culture, we'll talk Nicolas Cage in quirky romantic comedies, Honeymoon in Vegas, and Moonstruck.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome to another episode of Video Culture. I'm your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And this week, we're talking one of your most beloved and favorite actors, Matthew Essery.
It's
Nicolas
true.
Cage.
It's like I joked at the end of the last episode. It's the second part of my plot to make this into a stealth Nicolas Cage fan appreciation podcast.
We could almost have a side, like, second podcast just on Nicolas Cage movies.
He has done 115 films, so
that's quite an impressive resume there.
Yeah.
Well, and I'll just say, like we were talking about in the pre-show, Nicolas Cage is a Coppola. Like, Francis Ford Coppola is like his uncle or something.
He is, yeah. It's his uncle.
And I mean, he could have just, you know, been like a Kardashian type, right? But no, he wanted to make it as an actor. If he was going to make it as an actor, he was going to do it on his own wits, on his own, fruition. And that's why he changed his name to not Nicolas Coppola, it's Nicolas Cage, because he didn't want people to know that he was a Coppola. And, he challenges himself and continues to challenge himself and doing all these crazy films now,
Mandy and, like, The Color Out of Space and, he did Con Air, which is basically an action martial arts film. He basically plays Jean-Claude Van Damme in that movie. I mean, he does, like, weird, like, things like that. Like what, like, Academy Award winner is going to do a movie where he has a ridiculous mullet and spin kicks people? You know, it's stuff like that. Or does something like Ghost Rider. And then goes and does, you know, something like, you know, an indie drama like Joe, which is this real heartfelt, like, indie drama. And then he goes and does something completely insane like Color Out of Space, which is, like, this weird, like, Lovecraft horror film,
or this completely accessible movies that we talked about, National Treasure 1 and 2, where these are produced by Disney Films. You know, he kind of has, you know, yeah, he's kind of all over the map. To me, he's kind of like Johnny Depp that just does more films. You know,
it's almost
better at it.
Yeah, I was telling you in our pre-production meeting, the one thing I sincerely admire about Nicolas Cage, and there's a lot I honestly do, unironically, but I love the variety of things he's in. Like, I mean, he has got examples of every genre in his filmography, and he's got at least a couple of really successful critically and financially examples of every genre in his filmography. Like, I mean, he doesn't just dabble in these things. He gets in there and makes successful projects in those genres when he really doesn't have to. Mm-hmm. He could be a guy like Tom Hanks and just do dramas all the time, or he could be a guy like Bruce Willis and just do, you know, tough guy action movies and, you know, direct-to-video stuff where he phones it in, but he really doesn't do that. He always goes in there and tries to do interesting things, even in movies like what we're going to talk about today. Like, Honeymoon in Vegas, you know, not to get too far ahead, is a very kind of light film, but he still does interesting things in it, you know?
Well, that's where I was going with it. I mean, the two movies that we chosen this week, Honeymoon in Vegas and Moonstruck, were done, you know, really close together. Honeymoon in Vegas was like 92. Moonstruck was 1987. And so it was kind of like somewhat early in his career, as far as like being like a noted actor. And but these are two sort of like very lighthearted romantic comedies. They're not like extremely serious. They are, you know, they do kind of have a lot of heart to them. They are, you know, Honeymoon in Vegas is, you know, a little more fun, a little more just sort of straightforward. And, yeah, you know, and Moonstruck is more of this kind of a romantic, you know, thing with some comedy things happening.
It's,
you know,
it's
sort of more subtle. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a quirky film.
Yeah.
Like Honeymoon in Vegas is very kind of straightforward, mainstream, like mall fare, like what you would see in like a mall cineplex.
Mm-hmm.
And I just dated myself so much for that reference. Forgive me.
Well, but I think Honeymoon in Vegas though was one of those films that really, I mean, I with the notes in front of me, like the budget was $25 million, the box office was $35 million, but it picked up a lot in like those video, you know, video rentals, and because
it
like we're talking
film,
about
yeah,
like right in the early 90s, and this is a time period where we're all going to, you know, Blockbuster on Friday and Saturday night, and what are we going to get? You know what I mean? And yeah, I think it's one of those great like, oh, I'll check this out. You know, this looks like fun.
Yeah, and you know, Moonstruck is considered a classic romantic comedy at this point. I mean, it's, yes, it's revered by film critics, and it's considered a classic by audiences. I mean, it was recently inducted into the vaulted Criterion Collection of all,
wow,
of all things. So, I wow mean, it's rare for a movie like that to get kind of, you know, labeled with that, you know, prestige label. Because mm-hmm, it's just a real simple, like, quirky romantic comedy, but it's been really like vaulted by critics and fans alike.
Well, I mean, it did garner some attention on its initial release with a few Academy Awards, and that it did actually win. And we'll go over that in a little bit of the notes a little bit later. But first, let's talk about Honeymoon in Vegas. So, because this is a more kind of like, you know, fun story. It was written and directed by Andrew Bergman, who also was the screenwriter for movies like Fletch, Blazing Saddles, The Freshman, and he even wrote and directed another movie called Striptease.
Yeah, I mean Striptease notwithstanding, that's a pretty good resume of projects. I mean, those are some heavy-duty writing credits.
You know? And I mean, and Fletch was already a book, but I mean, somebody had to still take the book, take the ideas, and write it into a screenplay. And he was a co-writer in Blazing Saddles, and so yeah, I mean, he seems like a guy that's got a lot of real sort of quirky ideas, right? Real sort of quirky sort of attitude. You can't just like, you know, watch Fletch and be like, oh, a normal person wrote that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you probably wouldn't be friends with Mel Brooks and end up in the writer's room of Blazing Saddles if you were just considered like a straight-laced kind of guy, you know?
Yeah, you got to have a little zip, right?
Exactly.
So, and it's, it's only 96 minutes long. I mean, that's very rare for a lot of movies these days to be made even under 100 minutes. So.
Yeah, it's a very snappy film. It's kind of got like a sitcom quality to it in ways, but it's really elevated by the performances and the cast. But before we get into all of that, what's uh-huh Honeymoon in Vegas about, Ryan?
All right, so from IMDb, on her deathbed, a mother makes her son promise never to get married, which scars him with psychological blocks to a commitment with his girlfriend. They finally decide to tie the knot in Vegas, but a wealthy gambler arranges for the man to lose $65,000 in a poker game and offers to clear the debt for the weekend with his fiancée. Suddenly, the man is insanely jealous and pursues his fiancée and her rich companion, but finds pitfalls in his path as the gambler tries to delay his interference. That was written by Ed Sutton. You know, if you want to try your hand at writing, you know, some of these synopses, you can submit your own at imdb.com. We're not affiliated with imdb.com.
But it just saves us a lot of time.
Yeah, it does. But yeah, essentially, James Caan plays this, Tommy Corman, who's kind of like this Vegas, you know, Vegas wise guy, I guess you would kind of say, right?
Well, he's sort of a pseudo gangster. He's a professional gambler. Like, he's a guy who basically, you know, makes his money gambling in Vegas. So he's got that kind of like tough guy quality, but it mostly comes from just the fact that he makes his money by basically outsmarting other people.
Right. And, I mean, and what a great sort of character actor to play that than James Caan. I mean, James Caan has been in several films. I mean, I remember him, you know, being the writer that gets tied up, you know, in Misery. He's also like Buddy Elf's dad in Elf. I mean, he's just this everyman wise guy that's just like a little more slick, but, you know, with a lot of like sass and attitude. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that he was Sonny Corleone in The Godfather.
I mean, yeah, The Godfather. Yeah,
what a he's kind of the big bruiser of the Corleone family, and so what a classic character that is. And it's all because of Khan's presence, man. He has this kind of like just naturally tough vibe about him. Like, you don't mess with him.
Well, like the soft-spoken kind of tough. Like, yeah, he seems like your friend, but you're like, no, he's really kind of like seedy, right? Like,
yeah. I'm just waiting for him to punch me in the nose. Like, you know, he's saying really nice things to me, but he's going to sock me in the face, you know?
Right.
That's James Caan's whole vibe.
Exactly. Like, when he gets caught in the poker game, well, you bet it. You owe me $65 million. You know, he wasn't going to let it go.
Turns it on that quick, yeah.
Right, yeah, because he sees him in the lobby earlier, thinks that his girlfriend, which is played by Sarah Jessica Parker, like looks like this other girl, right?
His dead ex-wife. Yeah.
His dead ex-wife, which was Betsy, I think her name was?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then which was actually also played by Sarah Jessica Parker. So it's not a coincidence that they look alike. In the film, they just kind of made her, dressed her up different to play the Betsy Nolan character. But Donna Corman is how she's credited being associated with Nicolas Cage, because she does actually get married at the end of the movie. I don't know what her maiden name was, but, you know, anyway.
I'm not sure they ever say it, but no. But basically this movie's like a comedy version of that movie.
Oh, no.
in Decent.
Oh, I'm sorry. Donna was Tommy Corman's ex-wife. Betsy was Sarah Jessica Parker. I made a mistake.
Okay. It's okay. But so, but you get the point, ladies and gentlemen. But what I was going to say was Honeymoon in Vegas, in a lot of ways, is like the sitcom comedy version of that movie Indecent Proposal with Robert Redford and Woody Harrelson and Demi Moore.
Right.
It seems like it'd be a really seedy concept. But it's all played so super light and airy in Honeymoon in Vegas. Like, right. It's got a great cast of actors in it. Why don't you tell some of the people about the actors in this film, Ryan?
Well, and also, too, Indecent Proposal was made 1 year after in 1993.
You're right. So, I didn't even think about that, but you're right, yeah.
I just had to look that up, which, you know, because it is, yeah, if Honeymoon in Vegas is kind of like the comedic version of this, Indecent Proposal is the serious version of that. And in Indecent Proposal, there was no, like, game or anything. There was no, like, I lost a game and I owe a bet. It was just kind of like, I'll pay you $1 million for it, like, one night or whatever. But anyway, moving on, you know what else
Indecent Proposal didn't have?
Uh-huh.
It didn't have Pat MF-er Morita.
No, it did not. Pat Morita, man. Pat, I just want the cast is amazing. So yeah. Nick Cage plays Jack Singer, who's like a private detective, right? So, Pat Morita just like shows up in the middle of the film as a taxi driver in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're just like, oh, there's Pat Morita.
And I completely forgot he was in this, and it was such a joyful little moment to see Mr. Miyagi there, like hey, it's Pat Morita, yay!
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, he wasn't in much, but then, you know, the movies that he was in are just like completely enjoyable. Peter Boyle like shows up as like with that chief or whatever.
Yeah. That's a great little cameo. Like this Hawaiian chief guy who's obsessed with musicals.
You're just like, oh, there's Peter Boyle. Okay.
And he's got this ridiculous wig on. It's really funny. A very funny scene.
He always plays just like the craziest characters, man. They're all just like really kooky. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then Tony Shalhoub shows up as well. In one scene, and then also Ben Stein shows up. You know, it's like that great kind of like monotone Ben Stein. Yeah. So if I take a flight on Tuesday, could I get a? You know, he's playing the guy like holding Nicolas Cage up, trying to buy a plane ticket.
And that leads to a great Cage freak out where he's like, "You're not even flying today."
Well, that was the great thing about all his performances. I mean, he can just go from zero to just like flip out in just like, you know, a second. And it's beautiful to watch him flip out, though. It's just like absolutely great because he doesn't like yell or scream. Like when he raises his voice, it's really kind of like this screaming kind of announcer shouting almost.
Yeah. And the movie, because of his sitcom kind of trappings, gives him lots of reasons to be flustered. Yes. So you get lots of fun little like mini Nick Cage freakouts throughout the movie, and if you like that about Cage, this movie is really worth checking out because he has lots of little fun moments where he gets to have those kind of like panic, you know, screechy moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, panicky moments, a lot of pacing, a lot of, you know, sort of anxiety, a lot of sort of, you know, nervousness. Like where he gets all those like nervous tics and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, like his energy is really juxtaposed with Jimmy Kahn's energy. James Kahn's very like cool and relaxed throughout the movie, and when they kind of clash, it has a really nice feel to it because Cage is all manic energy, and James Kahn's all cool and collected and calculating. Mm-hmm. It gives it a nice feel.
Two other cameos, sort of, that I will mention, or just smaller parts, was in the, you know, when he goes to that airport. And in Utah, where he's kind of like trying to hitch a ride, you know, on a charter flight to Vegas. You know, he gets in the like the Flying Elvises, you know, plane or whatever. Well, the lead guy that's there is an actor named Burton Gilliam. And, he, you know, he's like, "Yeah, you fly to Vegas. Oh, come on. You got your suit." Yeah. You know. That guy was the same guy actually in Fletch who was the, you know, the mechanic at the airport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was.
Yeah. He's like, "Oh, you're doing some stunt flying or something." Like he's, it's almost like he's the same, almost the same character in like some universe of Fletch, you know, he's like the mechanic, but he also, maybe he moved to Utah. Right. And then he's like on the side, he's doing this Flying Elvis's, you know, gig or whatever. It's totally great.
Yeah. The Flying Elvis thing was, I always thought was pretty neat. It was also a big part of the marketing at the time. So much of the trailers and like TV spots were based around the skydiving Elvis thing. Mm-hmm. It's pretty wacky. Mm-hmm. And one thing I dug about the score was that, or not the score, but the soundtrack was nothing but Elvis covers. And as a guy who also likes Elvis, I really enjoyed that part of it. Like it starts off with like a great Bruce Springsteen cover, Bruce Springsteen doing an Elvis cover. Fun stuff, man. Just really fun stuff.
Yeah, he does Viva Las Vegas is the opening track. But yeah, and then one last thing I'll say about the Elvis, because also the dinner show, they go the first meeting between you know, Betsy and Tommy was like an Elvis impersonator show. And I don't know if you know this or not. I don't know if you looked it up or not. But the little Elvis, the little, you know, Elvis?
There's a kid impersonator. Yeah, there's a kid Elvis impersonator.
That was Bruno Mars.
You're kidding me. Really?
That was the Bruno Mars, dude. That is him.
That is, I did not know that. That's kind of mind blowing.
7 years old, doing like an Elvis impersonation.
Well, now I feel old. I don't know about you, but
yeah, because I looked at the credits like Bruno Mars in this movie. I didn't see him. I didn't see the bro. And then I was like, credit, little Elvis. What? I was like, oh my gosh. So yeah, if you want to see Bruno Mars when he was 7 years old doing an Elvis impersonation and singing, what was it? I Can't Help But Falling in Love with You, I think was the song he did.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's really, really great. And that's that's the kind of stuff that's in it. You know what I mean? Just like kind of a little bit of absurdity like that. Just a little bit of fun. It is kind of weird that, like, you know, at first Sarah Jessica Parker's, you know, like not really into this whole thing and kind of questioning the whole thing. And then like after one dinner, she's like going upstairs to pack to go to Hawaii.
Well,
you know,
I think in all fairness, James Caan is pretty charming, you know, when he wants to be.
Right.
And you got to remember that he is really rich. And I mean, I think anyone in this situation would be at least a little curious about what it's like to be around someone who's that wealthy, you know?
Right. Yeah. See how the other half lived and see all this other stuff that's going on, you know?
Yeah. But you have to have her go along with it too, because if you don't, there's no movie. And that's always going to be the problem with these kind of like sitcom premises. You have to have some lapses in judgment or character, because otherwise you wouldn't have the zany situations that create the movie.
Yeah. It is kind of creepy though, right? Like Tommy Corman, like just capturing this other guy's girl just to go, you know what I mean? To go to Hawaii.
And basically trying to trick her into falling in love with him. Yeah. It's pretty weird. Yeah.
Yeah. And also I will say that, you know, watching it from today's perspective, we still have to like transport ourselves back to a time before there was like everybody had a cell phone, you know, and you still had to rely on phones and answering machines and stuff like that. So
yeah, a cell phone would destroy this movie.
Oh yeah, completely.
There'd be no movie if anyone had a cell phone.
Yep, it'd be done. Because you know where they were, you could text them. They're not responding. You have GPS locators. I mean, so yeah, it's completely kind of silly, but that was the time that we lived in, and not that it was like easier to write movies like that, but it was just like those were just the times that we had, you know.
It's to me, it's always interesting to go back and look at it, because you kind of forget what it was like before all that stuff, and these movies are fun reminders of that, because it's a cliche, but it was a simpler time,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, to even buy a ticket to the to a plane, he has to go to the airport to buy a ticket. Like that's just such a odd, you know, thing to think about nowadays. You know, we don't think about having to go to the airport to buy a ticket.
It's true.
So, but still, I loved Cage's performance, and it was just such a fun movie, fun ending. And I mean, I don't think that you could have anybody else, you know, play Jack Singer, you know, as well as Nick Cage did. I mean,
he brings such a singular energy to everything he does that it's really hard to imagine any other actor in his place. Because when he's in a role, no matter what it is, he makes it a Nicolas Cage role, you know. Mm.
Right.
So, as we always talk about on the show, what would be your rewind moment on this? What would be the moment you would savor? What's your favorite moment from Honeymoon in Vegas?
I mean, I completely, like I just said, I love the ending. I love, you know, his nervous energy when he's on the plane, like when he gets on the plane, this sort of like climax at the end where he's flying, you know, and they still, you know, somehow like in the midst of the crowd, like, you know, can meet. I think it's one of the most unique endings I've seen to, you know, a movie in like a long time. And really, if you think about it, there's not a lot of action that goes on in the film. And so that was just like a very sort of action-y moment that was really kind of fun.
Yeah, I've convinced myself that the ending is why Nicolas Cage probably wanted to do the movie. Because he gets to have a thing where he skydives in, he's wearing a light-up Elvis jumpsuit, and his love interest is dressed like a Vegas showgirl. That just seems like the kind of thing that would really appeal to Nicolas Cage. It just feels very, very, again, just very Nicolas Cage. I think that part alone is probably what convinced him to take the role.
Well, I mean, there's also a lot of, you know, I was thinking about it too. He's a big Elvis fan, I know.
He is, yeah.
And there's a lot of, I guess, references to like Elvis movies and stuff like that. And there's probably like an Elvis fan out there who like watches all the movies. Like, yeah, this part is from this movie and this part is from this movie. And I wish I would have seen, you know, more Elvis films. But think about it. He did Vegas, right? And then flew to Hawaii where, you know, all Elvis mm-hmm. did a lot of films out there as well. So there's a lot of influence between, you know, between those two.
The spirit of Elvis definitely hangs heavy over the movie for sure.
Oh, for sure. Definitely. Yeah. And so, any moments that you would didn't savor as much or would want to fast forward through?
As for things I didn't like about the movie, there's not honestly. It's going to sound weird, but there's not anything I really didn't like about it, except for the fact that in the end they had to kind of up the creep factor on James Caan to make him truly an antagonist. Like throughout most of the movie, he's pretty nice and friendly, and he seems to honestly be trying to just woo this girl.
Yeah.
But it isn't until the end he has to kind of become like aggressive and controlling. And it seems like he did that simply because the movie's coming to an end and they need him to be clearly painted as a bad guy.
Right. They need Sarah Jessica Parker's like character to go, okay, this guy's a creep. Right?
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it took it a little bit too far probably for modern times, for today's, looking through 2020 culture. But yeah, for 92, it was probably, it was very quick and very fast. And audiences probably didn't dwell or think about it that much. You know, they knew he was kind of a creep to begin with anyway. You know, it was just kind of like, eventually you're going to get there because he's going to show his true colors, right? So...
Yeah, I don't think you're meant to dwell on anything in this movie, really. I think it's meant to just kind of snap, 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 and then the credits roll. You know?
Right. But yeah, I agree with you. I would probably say the same thing. I don't think that there's anything different. We just need more of that Bruno Mars performance, I think.
Well, I would honestly, that's the only thing I would like to see more of. I would love to see more of Peter Boyle.
Yeah.
He's so funny in that one scene he's in. I wish he had popped back up again at some point.
Yeah, you see Pat Morita, and before he leaves Hawaii, you see him like one more time. But yeah, it would have been nice to have them, kind of together or something like that. That would have been
Maybe somehow they help him, like that old trope of they help him get back to Vegas or whatever.
They're like, okay, well, And yeah, because then they hear about what's actually going on and, what Tommy Corman is doing. And they're like, okay. And then like turn against Tommy and help him out.
Yeah.
Something. Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be a little cliche, but it'd be nice to get them back in it a little more.
Yeah. I am with you, sir. All right. So let's move on to Moonstruck.
I lost my hand. I lost my bride.
He has his hand. He has his bride.
You want me to put my pain away? I love that scene, man. I love that scene.
I bake bread. Okay. All right. If you don't know what we're talking about, you're just missing out, and you need to go watch Moonstruck. It's only 102 minutes. And yes, it stars Cher, but she won she won an Oscar for her role for Best Actress in this film.
She's good in this. She really is.
She really is. And I mean, it was done for like $15 million. It made like $80.6 million.
It was huge. Yeah, yeah.
It was produced by a guy named produced and directed by a guy named Norman Jewison, who also did In the Heat of the Night, Fiddler on the Roof. The original Thomas Crown Affair, Rollerball. He also did another movie in the 90s called that didn't do so well. It's called Other People's Money. But yeah, it's just like a really sort of just kind of family love story, I guess you would say. But it's like all based upon being with the right person and, fate and, luck and curses and, all that kind of stuff. Like all that.
Yeah, just being in the right place at the right time, and it's a person you're with, the right person for you, and sometimes coming to terms with whether they're not, or maybe you have to work at it a little bit harder. Just the way that kind of love entangles our lives,
or ways. It's, you know, to me it's kind of like, you know, like fate, like, you know what I mean, kind of like the same way where in Honeymoon in Vegas, where, you know, the mom says, you know, you can't marry anybody, you know, nobody's gonna love me as much. So it's like, it's almost like he's cursed in the same sort of way with, you know, Cher, like her first husband got hit by a bus. And then so because it was, I can't remember what cursed their marriage. I can't remember
the fact that they didn't wait and have a real wedding.
Oh, right, right. They just got married at like City Hall. Yeah. And so, yeah, her marriage was cursed from the beginning. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And her fiance, played by Danny Aiello, a really old looking Danny Aiello, is a weird little bit of overlap with Honeymoon in Vegas. His mom is dying in the film, so he has to, they take him out of the plot, so he has to go be by her bedside through most of the film, mm-hmm. which allows the rest of the shenanigans to happen.
Right, right, right. Yeah, exactly. So let me, I'll just go over the quick plot right quick. Okay. No sooner does Italian-American widow Loretta accept a marriage proposal from her doltish boyfriend Johnny than finds herself falling for his younger brother Ronnie. She tries to resist, but Ronnie lost his hand in an accident and blames it on his brother, and has no scruples about aggressively pursuing her while Johnny is out of the country. As Loretta falls deeper in love, she comes to learn that she's not the only one in her family with this secret romance. And that was written by Jay Welsh 5742.
Well, thank you, Jay Welsh 5742.
But yeah, Cher plays Loretta. Castorini. I'm terrible with names. Nicolas Cage plays Ronnie, who's the guy that lost his hand. He has like a wooden hand.
Yeah.
Like a replacement hand. Olympia Dukakis plays the kind of the matriarch, the Rose Castorini. And Vincent Gardenia plays Cosmo Castorini. And we said Danny Aiello plays Johnny.
Yeah. Nick Cage in this movie is really in his, like, young rock star phase. He, despite him being quirky and having a wooden hand, he's cool. He's got, like, this, like, cool quality about him. You know, he's, you know, he's kind of got this, like, sad, like, face, but he's still got this kind of, like, 1950s, like, James Dean kind of quality to him in it.
Right.
You know, he's magnetic.
Right. Yeah, I think that he, didn't he do, like, Raising Arizona, like, the year before 86, is that right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, he's kind of, you know, he's just, I mean, he's just kind of like baking bread, but yeah, he's just, like, really, really cool. And they have, like, the oddest conversation. Like when he comes over to her house or whatever, her apartment, like that conversation that they had, their first conversation, is just like completely weird. You know what I'm
talking about? Where she's talking about how he's a wolf and he wanted to actually get out of his first engagement, so yeah. He injured himself intentionally,
right?
Yeah, so
well, I mean, and everything even leading up to that, like, oh, you need to eat, like, oh, I'll have my steak, you know, okay, well, if you're going to cook a steak, I'll have it well done. No, you'll eat it bloody, you know.
That little battle of wheels, yeah. That's, yeah, which, right. I mean, you're married, you kind of know, you have those moments sometimes where you're like, no, I like it this way, and your wife's like, no, I think you'll like it this way, and you kind of butt heads a little bit, and invariably, she's right.
Right.
You know? Because he does eat that bloody steak, and he's like, hey, this is pretty good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, yeah, you know, and then their whole, you know, love scene, you know what I mean? It's just, like, completely kind of over the top, you know. He's, don't be nothing all, left.
it's all quirky. Like these characters aren't real people. They're basically bundles of quirks.
Right.
But it's part of why Moonstruck works so well. It's because everyone in it is interesting. Like, even characters only on screen for, like, a moment are kind of a little bit off and weird. But not, like, overtly weird. Just, like, again, just full of, like, quirks and, like, personality.
Uh-huh.
So the movie is just filled wall-to-wall with interesting people. And that makes it very watchable. It causes it to flow very well.
What the thing that I love about this movie the most is the fact that we don't just look through everything through one person's eyes, right? Like we kind of see, like, if you were to compare the two movies, Honeymoon in Vegas is kind of like, but you know, between both Jack and what was the other character's name? Betsy, right? You're seeing them between those two characters' eyes. Moonstruck is kind of like, you're almost like a fly on the wall, and you're almost following two people at one time. You're following, you know, Cher's character, which is Loretta, and then you're also following, like, Vincent. You're following Cosmo, and you're kind of seeing their home life. You're kind of seeing the secret life. You're kind of getting a glimpse of all of these lives and how they're all intertwined with one another. And that's what I think that is great. It kind of gives you a very, like, backdrop where you feel like that you're there, like it's part of the scenery or whatever. Like you totally get that part of New York or Brooklyn or wherever that, you know, that they were. And that's why I think that it's fantastic. So,
The film really wants you to I think it wants to give you a sense of, like, you're in the family. You're in this extended family. And so you spend a little bit of time with each character to kind of see their hopes, their dreams, their frustrations. But it's all kind of filtered through the idea of romantic relationships.
Right.
And again, everyone in the movie is pretty likable. And you kind of enjoy spending time with all of them, which is really helpful in a movie that's so much of an ensemble like this one. The only thing about it is, man, to get back to our focus of this episode, Cage is just such a strong personality. Whenever he's on screen, he really just steals the movie every time he's on screen.
Well, I think that was his goal. I mean, I wouldn't call, like, there are certain people that I would call, like, scene stealers or whatever. Tommy Lee Jones might be one of those guys, right?
Typically, yeah. For better or worse, if you listen to our last episode, yeah, for better or worse. Yeah.
I mean, you kind of get the same sense with Cage, because it would have been easy for him to play it off, like, this way or that way. And he's just, like, really sort of, like, almost the top, sort of almost little more outlandish than some of the other characters, right? A little almost too much, where the director probably had to feel like he had to pull him back a little bit. You know what I mean? But
he makes big choices. Yeah.
Yeah. He did make some bold choices. But I think that it's great. And his passion and his portrayal is absolutely amazing. And really, this movie could be like a stage play. Like it really is kind of almost written that way. That's what I think that it's so great, because it mixes, you know, family and love and, you know, all of our sort of like, American, like, romantic, sort of things, right? Gotta have a ring to get engaged. Like, you gotta have a big wedding. You gotta, you know, do this, like, you know, I there are certain scenes where Cage is in, to go back to what you were saying, where, you know, like where after they go to the opera and, you know, he's on the street and he goes, "Get in my bed."
Yeah.
You're just like, my wife, she didn't watch the movie, but I'm watching it downstairs and she kind of laughed at that scene. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, who could take this person seriously? And actually, you know, that's his strategy to get this woman in his bed. You know, how's that going to work?
I don't know. But he's got this energy about him that I can kind of understand why people would be pulled in by him. Like something about him, man. He just radiates this kind of, like, wounded confidence, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he really is just a cult of personality.
Completely agreed. And then you want, just to talk about a little bit about the cast again. John Mahoney also appears in the film kind of sporadically in a couple different scenes.
You guys know him as the dad from Frasier.
Yeah, exactly. He was also in other movies like Say Anything. And he was in another, didn't he? Wasn't he in another movie that we recently talked about?
I'm shy. I want to say he was, but I cannot remember off the top of my head. And I didn't think to go back and look, to be honest with you.
Anyway, I just think that he's, you know, I love John Mahoney.
Yeah, he's always, it's always good to see him in films. He never hurts the film. He only helps.
Oh, for sure. And so, but I don't. I mean, I can't say enough great things about the movie, though. To be quite honest,
like it makes New York look so like alive and bustling and interesting. It makes me really want to eat Italian food. Like every time they're eating, it looks delicious.
Right.
You know, and when they go, the scene where Nicolas Cage takes Cher to the opera, it looks beautiful. They're dressed up so nice. They go to the Met, and it just looks like something out of a fairy tale, but not unrealistically. Like mm-hmm. It just looks so beautiful and well photographed, and the whole movie to me just kind of washes over me in like a really warm way. Like I don't find it laugh out loud funny, man, but I smile the entire time during it. Every time I watch it.
Oh, right. For our audience, John Mahoney was in the Manhattan Project, just to get that out.
That's what it was. Yeah.
But you're completely right. And I mean, I love, still the way that it's written, that, you know, Cher's, character Loretta, you know, Ronnie says, you know, meet me at the Met. And she's like, well, where's the Met? Like everybody who lives in New York, like knows where the Metropolitan Opera is, right? Like they know where the Metropolitan
Yeah, that one line tells you so much about her character right there. That's good screenwriting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, she's showing her naivete. Like, it's not even on her radar. Like, she doesn't even care about, like, those kind of things. That's not what she's, what her sort of motivation of her character is about. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, and then there's a scene where she's watching the opera, and you can tell she doesn't quite get it at first, but by the end, she's tearing up. Mm-hmm. It's really nice, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I just love how it all culminates at the end. Like, there's no real talking about a lot of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, Rose, you know, who plays by Olympia Dukakis, like, she calls out Cosmo, like, in the middle of that scene in that breakfast. And it was like, I don't want you to see her anymore. And that's all she says.
Yeah. Because she knew.
Right. And
she
then there's knew, just yeah. silence. And then, like, Cosmo just, like, kind of silently bangs on the table, you know, just kind of bangs on the table real quick because everybody's, like, real tense. And then that was, you know. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, just there's a subtlety to it, even though it's quirky, that is really admirable. It's I mean I can see why people always you know praise the script and the writing of Moonstruck. It's so wonderfully written. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so everything about it is just so well made, so well acted, so well cast. It's beautifully photographed. It's just such a nice, I mean, that's such a weird thing to say, but it's just a nice film.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right. I mean, it's, to me, I think it's a Woody Harrelson film without all the Woody stuff in it.
You're thinking of Woody Allen.
Woody Allen. Woody Harrelson. Woody Allen. Ah, you're my Woody, right?
We're leaving that in, folks. We're leaving that in.
Oh, Lord. I'll get some emails. White man can't jump. I know.
It's like a Woody Allen film.
You know, white man can't jump. Anyway,
it's like a Woody Allen film without the ick. Yeah, I get what you're. But I get what you're saying. It's like a Woody Allen film without the ick factor to it.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
I think it has that real sort of quality to it. I think
it does. Yeah. It does. So, what's your rewind and savor moment for this one?
I don't think that you can. I think that ending scene. Once again, it goes back to the ending, right? Like, I'm sorry. But back to the ending scene. I know what scene that you're gonna say, which is fine. You're not gonna say the ending scene, which I love. But I think the ending scene was completely awesomely choreographed. The pacing, the tension, you really felt like you were there, and it really holds your attention for like I don't know how long that scene is, but It's just absolutely fantastic. I'd sit and watch that scene over and over again. It's so fun.
It is. I mean, but so much of the movie is really fun. And of course, my favorite scene is the Nicolas Cage introduction, because he gets that great monologue, which I jokingly quoted in the beginning. I mean, it may be one of the best scenes of Cage's career, because it's so singular, and it so encapsulates mm-hmm. why he's unique and amazing, because it's ridiculous. It is so ridiculous, but he's so earnest about it at the same time, and it's so well done that you just believe he would act that way, even though it's completely out there and just crazy, for lack of a better word.
Well, yeah, like, well, because it's almost like a nervous breakdown, right? Because his character has been holding on to this for I don't know how long, right? And it finally all, you know, comes out, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, he's dramatically pointing at his wooden hand as he's screaming. Yeah. It's so good. I could watch that scene over and over again and get tickled by it every time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see why you love it so much. It was fun. Yeah.
And I'm going to say, I don't think I would change anything about it. I can't think of one thing that I think doesn't work well.
Mm-mm. No, I can't either. I mean, I'm really, like, trying to rack my brain. Like, what would I take out? And what scenes didn't really, you know, get me or whatever. And I can't really think of anything. I just absolutely, I thought it was fantastic. I think it's such an easy, you know, watch movie, even though that there's a little bit of drama, there's a little bit of romance, it's still somewhat fun. And, you know,
cannot recommend it enough. It's really easy to find on streaming. You can find it on, you know, any pay streaming services, even usually free on one of the ad supported streaming services. Like, it's so easy to see Moonstruck, and it's highly recommended, which leads me to the question we always ask about it, you know, as we kind of frame this around the idea of the video store trip. If you rented Moonstruck, Ryan, would you keep it an extra day, or would you get it back in time to avoid those late fees?
I would keep it an extra day.
Same here. I own Moonstruck. I actually bought the Criterion Collection Blu-ray.
Wow.
That's how I watched it for this episode.
Wow.
I think it's a great film. Yeah, it's one of Nicolas Cage's best works. It's definitely the best thing Cher was ever part of.
I mean, and for a guy, I mean, I've seen some of your collection, and I know what you have. I mean, you've got some really obscure, you know, kung fu films, and, you know, some other, you know, action movies and stuff like that. So I know you don't have a lot of romantic comedies like that. So that speaks a lot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's how good it is. I mean, it's such a great example of that genre that even if they don't like romantic comedies, can find things to enjoy about Moonstruck.
Right.
So same question about Honeymoon in Vegas. Would you get it back on time to avoid those late fees, or would you keep it an extra day and pay a little more to watch it again?
I mean, as fun as it is, and as much as I would say it's I would kind of like recommend it if you haven't seen it, I'd probably return it.
You know, I'm going to say I would probably hesitantly keep it an extra day and watch it again, because there are things I really like about it. You know,
it's true.
It's just so light and airy. I mean, it's basically, there's nothing of, it's not a movie of substance at all.
No.
And putting it next to Moonstruck really illustrates that, but it's still good. It's just, it kind of pales in comparison to a movie that's an all-timer, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I loved seeing all the characters in Honeymoon in Vegas, and I thought that, you know, Nicolas Cage and James Caan just, you know, hit it out of the park on that one. And it's really, you know, it's really great. But yeah, it is kind of, I think, one of those things that, you know, I know Nick Cage, the way that he chooses films is like, you know, can he see himself doing this? And I know he was like jumping out of a plane in an Elvis suit. Yeah, I'm doing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, it is that kind of, you know, fun movie for sure. And he even, well, we'll get to the notes in a minute, but he has a connection to Elvis, which I know you know of, but anyway.
Well, let's talk about that trivia, Ryan.
Okay. He actually married Elvis's daughter, right?
That's true.
He married, from what was the notes that I have, that he was married to Lisa Marie Presley, between 2002 and 2004.
Yeah, which is longer than you would think, because I remember it being shorter than that, but 2 years, I mean, that's not bad for a celebrity, for a guy who's been married a lot, like Nicolas Cage.
He's been married 4 times. He married Patricia Arquette. They were married between 95 and 2001, and then 2002, 2004 is with Lisa Marie Presley. Then from 2004 to 2016, it was with Alice Kim, and then it was, you know, then married Erica Kolke. I don't know how to pronounce her name.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
Yeah, but it married and divorced in the same year, so that didn't last very long at all.
It always blows my mind that he was married to like the mid 90s Patricia Arquette, because God, she was beautiful. Or she still is, but I mean, she was amazing in the mid 90s.
Like, well, what a lucky man. I mean, man. And she was married to Michael Jackson for a little while, right? So
yeah, Lisa Marie Presley was, yeah.
Yeah. So, but I mean, yeah, but that connection to Elvis, like, you know, totally crazy. But anyway, let's get to the notes, shall we?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So, Honeymoon in Vegas, director and writer Andrew Bergman said about the film, quote, "It wasn't based on anything. I wanted to do a boy-girl story, and in my perverse fashion, it turned out to be this." So, yeah. So there you go. Just kind of a fun story, right? The film was initially rated R for language and was edited to instead to receive a PG-13 rating. So, I mean, I guess there was some more bad language from James Caan or Nicolas Cage or whatever, but they didn't want it to be rated R. They wanted it to be PG-13. I think that was probably a smart move on their part.
Yeah, because there's no reason this movie should be rated R, really. I mean,
yeah. Among the filming locations in Kauai was the Inn on the Cliffs restaurant, located at the Westin Kauai Hotel, just in case anybody wants to go and visit there. If you do, just give me a call. I'd be glad to go with you. Jack pulls both the yellow... this always bothered me about this film, okay? And this is why I bring this up. So when they're about to jump out of the plane... Or, like, when he's on the plane and he's like, what do I do? He's like, well, you pull the yellow chute, and if that don't go, you pull the red chute. Then when he jumps out of the plane, he pulls both the yellow. He goes, yellow, red, like, pulls both of them. But that's not correct according to what, you know, was supposed to be said. So it's, red is just a backup chute. That technical thing, like, always bothered me.
Yeah. I just figured maybe Nicolas Cage just wanted to yell some more.
Yeah, I think it's just showing his nervousness about the whole process, right?
Yeah.
The film soundtrack, like you said, is full of Elvis covers done by, you know, modern artists such as Bruce Springsteen, Jeff Beck, Billy Joel, John Mellencamp, Dwight Yoakam, Travis Tritt, Vince Gill, Amy Grant, Willie Nelson, Trisha Yearwood, and Bono from U2. So most of the songs can be found on the CD soundtrack, minus Bruce Springsteen version of Viva Las Vegas, the movie's opener. Also, Willie Nelson's not on there either. The soundtrack peaked at number 18 on the U.S. Billboard Top 200 and number 4 on the U.S. Billboard Top Country Albums.
Yeah, it was really popular at the time.
Yeah. I remember a couple of those songs played on like country radio just because they were fun, right? It was nominated for Best Picture, Musical, or Comedy, and Best Actor for Nicolas Cage in the 50th Golden Globe Awards, but did not win either of those categories. The winner of those categories at that time was the movie The Player, starring Tim Robbins, who took both. That movie won both Best Picture for Musical Comedy and Best Actor for Musical Comedy.
Well, and in fairness, like I said, I like Honeymoon in Vegas. But it is very slight, so I totally get why it didn't win.
Yeah, yeah, and The Player is one of those movies we will have to might put on our list.
Yeah,
it's a fun one too.
It is, and we definitely need to talk about some more Tim Robbins at some point.
Oh yeah. The budget was $25 million. The box office $35 million. So it didn't really, you know, knock it out of the park there. But like I said, I think it picked up a little bit more steam, more notoriety in the film rental, as we say, in the home rental market. Roger Ebert gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars.
Yeah, I remember him liking it. I didn't realize he liked it that much, but I remember him being positive on it.
Yeah, he said Andrew Bergman has a gift for touchables like that, in which the storyline takes amazing twists and turns to include wonderfully bizarre developments. And also goes to say Nicolas Cage is one of those actors that some people like and others find excessive. I tend to like him, especially when he is consumed by love, as he was in Moonstruck, and again here.
Well, that ties it together very well.
I read that quote, and I was like, that's my closing arguments, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
That's why he's our patron saint of the show, yeah.
Old Saint Nick.
Old Saint Ebert, yeah.
Rotten Tomatoes critic score for Honeymoon in Vegas, 63%. Audience, 35%.
That's weird to me, because most people I know love Honeymoon in Vegas.
Yeah, I know. I found that really odd to have such a low audience score. But either way, there was a musical stage Broadway version of the movie Honeymoon in Vegas that was crafted up in 2012 and debuted at the Paper Mill Playhouse in New Jersey with Tony Danza as Tommy Corman.
Huh. That's all I got for that is, huh.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Didn't last that long. And never really made it to like mainstream Broadway either. So Moonstruck, moving on to Moonstruck. Nicolas Cage's screen test didn't impress the studio, and they wanted to get somebody else to play Ronnie, but Cher insisted that Cage was the one to play that role and threatened to quit unless he was hired. After a few days, the studio relented.
Well, obviously, that was the right call.
Oh, for sure. And Cher knew it. So, I mean, that's pretty bold of her to step up and say, well, I'm not going to do this film if you're not going to hire, you know, Nick Cage, because he's the one to do it.
Yeah, they look so good together. Something about their eyes, they really suit each other in the film.
Mm-hmm. Screenwriter John Patrick Shalaney wrote that the film's script with Sally Field in mind for the lead role.
I can see Sally Field doing it, but again, Cher does such a good job. I have a hard time really picturing anyone else, but Sally Field is a great actress, and I can see her pulling it off, but I don't know if it would have been as memorable.
I don't think she can pull off like Italian like the way Cher did, though.
Yeah, and I can't see her acting out to Nicolas Cage.
Like she did, right?
Yeah, I also can't see her keeping up with Nicolas Cage. Like, Nicolas Cage would have blew her off the screen.
Yeah. Director Norman Jewison was fined by the Actors Union for not allowing his actors to go to lunch until they perfected the moods of their characters for the climax scene in the kitchen. Apparently they like worked on it over and over and over again because he wasn't like feeling like he was getting it right and it wasn't consistent. So he had to like really work with them, and he actually had the cameras like turn off. And he had them rehearse it over and over until they got it right. And it took like a long time. And I think that work like really pays off in that final scene. I think that
it does,
you know,
it does, man. It's such a delicate scene and it could go off the rails so easily. And it's, and you can tell that a lot of thought and care went into it.
Mm-hmm. John Mahoney did later reveal that, that his role in the film got him widespread attention and helping him get cast in the TV series Frasier. Because, I mean, it was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Supporting Actor. It won in the categories for Best Actress for Cher, Best Supporting Actress for Olympia Dukakis, and Best Original Screenplay.
So. Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's so well-crafted, and John Mahoney's really good, and he gets a few, like, great monologue scenes. Everyone gets great monologue scenes in Moonstruck.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just full of great stuff.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm saying it's just full of great stuff. Everyone gets like showcase moments.
Well, and you've watched the Oscars, right? Like,
yeah.
Part of the Oscars of being nominated is just hearing, you know, your name or the film mentioned, right? And anytime the film makes it in more than one category, like, you immediately know, and like everybody who watches like knows, right? you know, it was like this character in this movie, you know. So if you see a movie over and over, and it's nominated in six categories, so they had to say that movie over and over, and, you know, it was probably very prominently, you know, shown at the Academy Awards, and clips were shown, and then audiences got interested in it and watched it and rented it after it came out on video and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, very popular film. The films that won for Best Picture was The Last Emperor. Also won Last Emperor, won for Best Director. And the Best Supporting Actor went to Sean Connery in The Untouchables.
Yeah, which I like The Untouchables, because this is a little bit of a side note. Uh-huh. But Sean Connery is just Sean Connery. I mean, you know.
I think they wanted to give him an Oscar. But yeah, this was the same conversation we had of Broadcast News, because Broadcast News was in the same...
I remember that now. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So, anyway. Roger Ebert. And this was the only movie that was nominated for Best Picture that either Cher or Nicolas Cage was in.
Oh, you mean best? Oh, nominated for Best Picture. Yeah. But Cage won an Oscar.
This was the only film that he was in that was nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah, it took me a second to put that together. I've had a long day. So thanks for putting up with me. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's fine. No, and I don't mean like they were together, because this is the only movie that they're in a movie together.
I get what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Either one of them were in. Roger Ebert did love this movie, gave it 4 stars. And it's the, it is included in Robert Ebert's great movie list. Okay. So he says Moonstruck is a romantic comedy founded on emotional abandon and poignant truth, and goes on to say the movie makes you laugh, which is very difficult, but also makes you feel more open to your better impulses. And that is harder still.
Yeah. He had a way with words. He really did.
I mean, I would never think to write that. It's amazing. Even Chicago Tribune and his partner on the TV show, what's the name of their TV show? Was it
You're talking about Gene Siskel.
Yeah, because Robert Ebert wrote for the Chicago Sun Times.
Yes, he did.
And the Chicago Tribune writer was Gene Siskel. He said Moonstruck, which is being sold as a romance, but is actually one of the funniest pictures to come in quite some time. So,
yeah. I mean, it's well loved, and for good reason.
Rotten Tomato critic score 94%. That is way up there. It's not Broadcast News like 98%, but it's still up there. Audience 81%.
Yeah, it's pretty well loved by everybody. Everyone can agree that Moonstruck is great.
Yep. So, and then I was thinking of what would I recommend, okay? And, you know, I thought about, there is another movie, and I don't want to confuse everybody if you're not familiar with Nick Cage's filmography, but he's in this other movie in the 90s called Leaving Las Vegas, which is a completely different movie than... Honeymoon in Vegas, and it is not a comedy at all, and it's a very sad, depressing film. And
but it's good.
It's good.
It's the one he won the Oscar for. Yeah.
Yeah. That was the one he won an Oscar for. But very sad and depressing. So I thought about like other movies that he was in, and I have a hard time always like with these recommendations, because it's like, what did you really like? Do you really like Honeymoon in Vegas? Do you want a movie like that, or do you want a movie like Moonstruck, or do you want another like Nicolas Cage movie? And so it's like hard to put all of those together, and you know, to come up with something, because I think about if I had to come up with another sort of movie that's kind of like I mentioned, you know, Raising Arizona, where he's like really frantic and stuff like that, but there's also another movie that he did called Peggy Sue Got Married, which he kind of like, it's kind of almost like a Back to the Future kind of thing, where kind of this girl finds herself like going, like waking up and seeing her life, like, where she's a kid again or whatever, and making different choices. And Nicolas Cage is like her boyfriend at the time. And her name is Peggy Sue. And I've always like really liked that movie. And I always, Nicolas Cage, like really kind of had an over the top performance in that as well. I don't think he gets enough credit for, I think if you liked Moonstruck, another movie that really is reminiscent of that type of film is the one that Nick Cage is not in, which is a movie called My Big Fat Greek Wedding. And I think that it's very much kind of along the same vein as Moonstruck.
I agree that that's a good call out. Yeah, but it's more about a Greek family, but it's still got the same kind of cultural quality,
mm-hmm.
where you get to see, you know, you could be inside another big family. He's going through a romantic event. And you're right, that they would make a great double feature. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's and really, My Big Fat Greek Wedding was taken from a play. Like, it was a play that got made into a movie. But it's also very fun. A lot of like family tradition, a lot of, old world, new world, and talking about like the American sort of immigrant experience. Right. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I think those are great choices. I really do. For me, I've just got one, but I think it's a pretty fitting one. Because Nicolas Cage did another romantic comedy, written and directed by the same guy who did Honeymoon in Vegas, called It Could Happen to You, and it came out in 1994. It starred, of course, it stars Cage, and it stars Bridget Fonda and Rosie Perez, and it's a really fun kind of light movie. It's about a police officer who agrees to, if he wins the lottery, he's going to split his lottery winnings with this waitress who was nice to him, mm-hmm. and surprise, surprise, he wins the lottery, and he actually does split the winnings with her, and kind of the fallout from that. And it's just a nice small movie. Is that kind of a similar kind of vibe to Honeymoon in Vegas? It's fun, and if you like Honeymoon in Vegas and you want another one like that, mm-hmm. Then It Could Happen to You is a really good compliment film to that.
Yeah, I don't get to really see like Bridget Fonda and Rosie Perez in movies hardly anymore.
But I believe Bridget Fonda is pretty much retired now. Rosie Perez was actually recently in a superhero movie called Birds of Prey, which was the Harley Quinn movie.
Mm-hmm.
She played a big part in that, but Bridget Fonda, I believe, is pretty much retired now.
Yeah, that's just kind of unfortunate. But yeah, that's another great accessible movie, and I completely forgot about that. But that was another movie I think that was kind of like the same sort of vein, like you said. And I don't think it really did a whole lot like in the movie theaters, but it was like one of those that like, we'll check this one out. This one out at the rental and see what it's really all about. Yeah. Right? Like,
it's a video store staple, my friend.
Exactly, and, for sure.
And of course, Nicolas Cage has had a long and varied career. And I will sneak more of his movies into this show if I can help it. But I think that kind of wraps her up for this week, my friend.
Yeah, very much so. So I have to look. Do you know what's on the for our next?
I'm going to say we haven't quite. We've got a whole list of ideas, but we haven't decided yet. So we're gonna leave you with a cliffhanger. It'll be on the website by the time this comes out.
Mm-hmm.
So just check there to see what's coming up next. We promise it'll be fun, and it'll be in a different genre than this one.
All right. Well, we hope that you are continuing to have a safe and joyous 2021. And until next time, we will see you later. Thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Esri. Go watch some movies, guys.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
Jack, if I go, I want you to make me a promise that you'll always love me.
Of course, Mom.
And you'll never get married.
I need a commitment. I want to be married. I can't
walk out. Jack Singer has made his decision.
Let's just do it. Get on a plane, go to Vegas, and do it. Now.
Jack is going to get married.
You're serious?
I must be. My legs are paralyzed.
But a funny thing happened on the way to the wedding.
Sorry, man. Straight flush to the jack.
To the queen.
Wise men say.
Yo, Tommy Coleman, $65,000.
Only fools rush in.
Eddie, do you have a solution?
I do. I want your girlfriend for the weekend.
You brought me to Las Vegas and you turned me into a hooker, Jack?
I'll be a perfect gentleman.
He's taking me to Hawaii.
No!
Address is near Kapa'a'a. Is it Kapa'a'a or Kapa'a'a'a?
If you want to leave, believe me, I understand.
Is it A-A-A or A-A?
It's just a little overwhelming, you know, to be pursued like this.
What about near where Don Ho or Jack Lord lives? That must be a pretty good neighborhood.
Boy, the women, when they come here, oh, they get crazy. They like freaky freaky all night long.
No one ever was as crazy about you as I am.
Well, that's just so wonderful to hear.
Let's just fly to Vegas and get married and go on with our lives.
Just get me anywhere where I can get a connecting flight to Las Vegas.
Las Vegas, anybody!
Come on, hop aboard.
We're the Flying Elvis, Utah chapter.
Well, bless my soul.
The king may be dead, but Jack Singer's not far behind.
Listen, if you could just drop me.
Oh, yeah, we'll sure drop you.
Honeymoon in Vegas.